On this episode of Skeptico.
Earlier on, you were kind of defending the mainstream media, saying, hey, they don't get everything wrong. Certainly, they don't get everything wrong.
There is no inconsistency in my perspective. It's highly coherent. I spent years developing it. I feel that you're not, like, I don't know, maybe we would need to spend 6 hours haranguing this out. I don't think it's going to happen in one podcast.
Okay. I think it's okay to disagree. So, I mean, I don't have a problem that you don't see my ideas as coherent or even sensible or anything like that, or that I don't see yours as coherent. I mean, that's really not the issue.
I'm going to meet you with the same level of force that you're meeting me, because otherwise I feel that, you know, it's just like, I'm not even getting a listening here. I'm sorry, you know?
That's why I paused before to make sure that you had a chance to talk. So let me kind of respond to what you're saying in really a new way, okay, that I think relates to your book in an important way, in the way that is synergistic with my approach. Because, you know, is it possible that the material world that we're talking about, right? Because there's this spiritual extended consciousness world that we're talking about early on that may exist and may have a totally different set of rules than this material and justifies the means, we have to do this or do that. Those two worlds could be different in some important ways that we don't realize. I'm just throwing that out as a possibility. So isn't it possible that it's true what a lot of spiritual teachers tell us, is that in some way we don't quite understand the world is always perfect, just the way that it is?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. Today's guest definitely fits in that category. Daniel Pinchbeck is a leading thinker about consciousness, and he has a lot to say about science in his new book, How Soon Is Now? So why did we wind up having a conversation that sounds like some kind of frickin' political debate? Well, I don't know, but I think I have some ideas and I need to talk about them, because this crap has been going on for too long now. Ever since this crazy election in the United States, a lot of people in the parapsychology, near-death experience, extended consciousness, whatever you want to call this realm, have been on tilt. And they seem to have a completely different political viewpoint than I do, which is fine, except that I'm tired of these folks completely ignoring my position because I don't agree with them. Look, as I've stated on this show, politically, I am post-partisan. I think Bush was a war criminal. I think Cheney and Rumsfeld were war criminals. I am not Republican. And I voted for Obama the first time, but when he turned out to be of the same ilk, of the same cloth as Bush, and started locking up whistleblowers and doubling down on the Patriot Act and doing everything possible to perpetuate war and do all that other crazy stuff, I voted against him. And in this latest election cycle, I voted for Hillary. Truth be told, I voted for Hillary to keep peace in the House, and because I'm in California, my vote didn't matter, and I didn't think there was any way in hell that outsider like Trump could win. But still, I voted for Hillary because I don't put any stock in this Republican Democrat nonsense. But as you'll hear in today's interview, and as you've heard if you've checked into the Skeptico forum lately, people that are all pissed off about the political situation in the United States cannot hear any of that. And that's scary. You know, I've said on this show, it's about following the data, and then it's not really about following the data, because people don't change their positions. Well, let me go back. It's about following the frickin' data. If you think climate change, I can't even say that with a straight face. If you think global warming is real, fine, bring it. Bring the data. But don't expect everyone to agree with you, because they don't. Because there's a lot of very qualified climatologists, as we explored in this show, probably at least 40%, who don't agree with you. And if you think, as Daniel does, that the only reason people don't agree with you is that they haven't been presented with the options as you see them, you're living in bizarro land. No matter what your position is, there's people who've explored the other side and come to a different conclusion. That's the nature of debate. So let's all come to our senses. As flawed as science is, let's lean on science a little bit to try and get a first cut at figuring out what the data is really telling us. So this interview with Daniel Pinchbeck was contentious, but you know what? It was a good dialogue to have, and it's a good dialogue to get out there. It's a good dialogue to stimulate conversation and real thinking, no matter which side you take and no matter who you agree with. And let me tell you something else. If you think this is a discussion about climate change or global warming, it's not. It's a dialogue about how we take our understanding of who we are and how we then project that onto other people, how we interact with them, how we take that and figure out how we're all going to do the next thing that we're going to do together. So I have a couple more thoughts on this, but I'll hold off to the end of the interview. And I also want to fill you in on the very interesting email exchange that I had with Daniel after the interview. So stick around. Here comes my interview with Daniel Pinchbeck, author of How Soon Is Now. Today we welcome Daniel Pinchbeck to Skeptico. Daniel is an author and well-known figure in the modern consciousness transformation movement that we talk so much about on Skeptico. He's the creator of Evolver.net and Reality Sandwich, which we've spoken about and had interviews about before. His books include Breaking Open the Head, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and his latest that we're going to talk about today, How Soon Is Now, From Personal Initiation to Global Transformation. Daniel, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start by talking about the title, How Soon Is Now. It's a little bit off, I found, from a lot of the content in the book. What were you trying to get at there with the title?
Well, actually, late in the book, I talk about, there's a chapter on like the idea of revolution. And I talk about a little bit about this Herbert Marcuse, who talked about how humanity feels an underlying guilt over something that we've postponed. And that thing that we've postponed is actually our own liberation. So for me, that moment when we were no longer in a state of postponement, you know, when there's no longer a delay space, in a sense, between the world that we, you know that we should be bringing into being and the world that we're kind of inhabiting, that would be the now.
I think that's a great point, and it's something that we talk about a lot here. And the point being this idea of action, right action, when to take action. You know, from a Buddhist or a yogic perspective, that's, of course, a deep question, because there's always the question of who is really acting anyway and what actions are the right actions. And then from a worldly perspective, there's the question of unintended consequences. What is some of your thinking about the question of right action? You were just touching on it there a minute ago, but it's complicated, right?
It's complicated. I mean, I definitely think that it's, and actually I explored ideas around kind of free will and determinism in the 2012 book. And I ended up, kind of putting out the idea that it's inherently paradoxical, that on the one hand, it's all cause and effect, and even on the psychological and the level in terms of our social conditioning. But then, if you shift your identity, if you take a more like Eastern mystical perspective, there's kind of one consciousness that's unfolding through all of it. And, you don't have to identify with your little kind of ego condition. You could actually kind of identify with the I am that, which is what Eastern mysticism talks about.
Right. But then when people are trying to connect that and operationalize that, whether you're the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh, there's these deeper questions about what is the right action. In your book, this present book, you talk a lot about huge social changes that you're advocating that I think a lot of people would kind of pull back a little bit and say, hey, is that the kind of right action? Are we sure that that's the right thing for me to do personally? And then from a societal standpoint, if each individual is choosing what's the right thing for their journey, how do we come together without something that's coercive or these other bad things that we've seen so much in the last, decade and beyond?
Yeah. I guess I always try to step back and take a kind of systemic perspective. And you know, for instance, I kind of look at our situation almost from an evolutionary biological viewpoint in my own way, not in the kind of reductive way that maybe some of the alt-right people have been using it. But, you know, I think in a way there is an evolution towards, you know, us gaining a realization of ourselves as a kind of planetary superorganism that has a symbiotic relationship with the ecology of the Earth as a whole system. And the fact that we've, you know, damaged the environment to the extent that we have is kind of, you know, almost going to ultimately force that realization, you know, either through, you know, more or less cataclysm, you know, I would say. And ultimately, we're going to have to find a way to bring our actions in alignment, you know, with what the ecosystems can allow for on this planet. You know, we may also be able to get off this planet and go to other planets and try other things. So, you know, I do feel that, you know, the you know, I guess I feel sympathetic with the Buddhist idea that there's an underlying, you know, kind of compassion that we can tap into, and empathy and altruism, and that those are going to be kind of, you know, ways that we guide ourselves back into balance. You know, I mean, and some of that requires being willing to take responsibility for, you know, the larger collective, the human family as a whole, the community of life that we're now inflicting so much harm on. So if we were to just, you know, kind of collectively decide that was a direction that we wanted to go into, you know, then the book then looks at the ways we could go in that direction, how we would have to redesign our technical systems and our social systems to allow us to have a long-term continuity and thrive here.
Okay. At the same time, the book is pretty strong in terms of taking a position in terms of what we have to do that, to me, is a little bit at odds with some of that. You write about the Paris climate talks of 2015, and you say, which a lot of people agree with you, you know, they don't go nearly far enough, and that we need to, this is your writing, eliminate wasteful industries, severely limit consumption, reduce air and car travel to a minimum, restrict meat eating globally. I mean, I think a lot of people in this collective spiritual community would find that a little bit heavy-handed and a little bit like, how are you going to get there, Daniel, without being just as coercive, just as heavy-handed as the people you're trying to unseat?
No, I really don't believe in coercion. I believe that, as I said, you know, my presumption is that, you know, given the opportunity, people will want to make changes for the benefit of their children and their descendants. And yes, according to the huge preponderance of scientists, we need to radically reduce, you know, and then eliminate, you know, CO2 that we're putting out into the atmosphere. And they talk about something like 8-10% CO2 reduction per year is what we should be aiming at. And I know that sounds almost ha-ha compared, you know, when we think about Trump and, you know, Rex Tillerson and the drilling and so on. But I'm hoping that in a sense, what's happening now is kind of, you know, almost like a last gasp of an old system. And hopefully without it bringing about too much more destruction, it will also help us have an awakening as to where we do need to go in the immediate future. And yes, yeah, so, you know, so for instance, I'm interested in, you know, creating voluntary opportunities for people to say, like, well, you know, what do I value and how do I want to act? And, you know, would it be possible for me to, you know, invest less on another car or on more vacations or on, you know, keep eating meat? You know, if I know that's going to have a damaging impact on, you know, the community of life and my own descendants and so on. You know, so I think in a way it's very much about messaging and about, yeah, how it's presented and the kind of social tools that also could be offered to people to go in that direction, if that makes any sense to you.
It does. I mean, like you, I consider myself an environmentalist. I'm super concerned about the number of environmental crises we seem to be facing that seem impossible to solve, you know. But I'm also interested in considering the possibility that some of the scientists who are on the other side of, in particular, the CO2 issue, you know, may have something to say. And I think that they're not often listened to in the same way that everyone else is listened to. You know, just this week we had ClimateGate 3.0, where this whistleblower came out yet again, same old story, said, hey, you know, high level, respected guy preparing the report for the 2015 Paris conference says, hey, I was prevented from presenting the real data. There was an organized effort to present a picture that didn't conform with what I had found, which was there was a stall in global warming. So, you know, we all accept that big oil is out there and they're conspiring to coerce science. But gosh, after ClimateGate 2, climate and this latest thing, don't we also have to acknowledge that there's all these other players on the other side who are just muddying up the waters? How are we supposed to really come to the kind of conclusion that would allow us to make those kind of monumental changes that you're talking about, or that we all know if you buy into that kind of global warming scenario are absolutely necessary? Because you're right. If you accept that, then those changes have to be made. How do we sort out both the science and then the decision to make those kind of changes?
I mean, I guess I end up being a little bit flummoxed by the people who still are kind of stuck in the denier mode. You know, I mean, I'm 50 years old, you know, and I can remember how, you know, much colder it was in winters. I mean, this winter in New York, you know, there were like in late January, people were wearing T-shirts. You know, when my mother was a girl, she was, you know, they were sometimes able to walk across the Hudson River. It was frozen over so much. And that's never happened in my lifetime. We're putting in 1 million tons of CO2, industrial CO2, into the atmosphere every hour. We know that it's a narrow sheath. I mean, it's like, you know, it's quantifiably measurable, right? We have more than 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere now. The last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, we know that sea levels were 100 feet higher, and you know, the temperatures were 4 degrees Celsius warmer. We also know that just doesn't happen through like an incremental shift. There are breaks in the system and sudden, you know, kind of you know, jumps, partially, you know, released through like you know, the frozen deposits of methane, which are already starting to thaw, which are 30 times more potent as a heat-trapping gas than CO2. You know, beyond the very, very obvious and overwhelming evidence of the CO2 that for some reason people have a hard time believing, you know, we can also look at things like ocean acidification. You know, the oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago. This is leading to a breakdown of the coral reefs around the planet. The coral reefs hold a huge amount of ocean biodiversity, so that's a big loss. You know, we can also look at many other factors that are happening. And we look at deforestation, the loss of the forest. I mean, no, species extinction. That's the other one I was going to point out. You know, we according to the UN estimates, you know, we're losing 150 to 200 species per day. I believe they estimate there's 8.7 million total species on the planet. So if you sort of do the math, that equals to us losing 10% of the Earth's remaining biodiversity every 10 to 15 years, right? So, and that's happening because we're, you know, taking away the tropical forests and other densely, you know, inhabited regions, converting the soybean plantations and developing them, you know, whatever, you know, so, you know, how many more decades or 15 year periods of 10% loss of biodiversity can we stand? Because we've also learned that the whole web of life is tightly meshed together. So for instance, if we wipe out the bees and the butterflies, you know, that's all of our pollinating species and so on. So I honestly think that this is a ridiculous argument to be having. You know, we're clearly in an ecological mega crisis, and there's every indicator from almost every reputable scientist tells us that. And there's a lot of money on the other side. So we don't even know how clever and cunning these people are in terms of spreading disinformation through these, like, you know, so-called climate gates and so on. And it really feeds on a kind of like rebel, hyper-individualistic mindset that has also led to this whole alt-right thing, I'm sorry to say. You know, so I would, if I were you, develop some skepticism towards your skepticism.
Well, there's so much there to pull apart, and I think that's the hard part of this issue. I am with you on the species reduction. I am with you on the environmental problems that we face, acidification of the ocean, coral reef, all these are huge problems. But what a lot of people are saying, and I am kind of in their camp in a lot of ways, is that a lot of the CO2 stuff and the global warming stuff gets lumped into a lot of other things where it becomes this mishmash of issues. So is the planet warming? Yes, there's no disagreement. And even if you take, I love the word denier, you know, I mean, because you can just apply that label to anybody and then they're smeared. But if you take the climate deniers, like the person I always point to is climatologist at Georgia Tech, Judith Curry, who is extremely highly regarded, is really pretty level-headed, middle of the road. And who's someone, if you listen to her, says, look, I was on the side of the consensus, more or less, until ClimateGate happened, and I really, in 2009, and I really looked at the data, and I looked at the manipulation of it, and it caused me to take another look at that. Now, there's a number of other people who have taken that same position. So do we really have to say, you know, oh, this is all settled science, we all kind of know everything, when there's a lot of pretty important, well-informed people who are saying, you know, if you really look at the ice core samples, like you talk about in your book, just, we can't get into a big climate debate. It'd take the whole time. But in the book, you say, look at the ice core samples.
So why do we not, I mean, since I, from what, you know, you're bringing up what people always do, is they bring up one or two renegade scientists, you know, I mean,
science. Renegade scientists. She was called to testify in Congress. I mean,
we can obviously see everywhere we go around the planet, you know, we have huge cities. We know we're putting in 1 million tons of CO2 in the atmosphere. We know the measure that it's gone up from, you know, 275, which was stable climate.
Correct. No one disagrees with you, Daniel.
We know the oceans are absorbing a huge amount of the industrial CO2, you know, that have led them to be 30% more acidic over the last 40 years. What is the discussion here? I don't actually understand, to be honest, but I don't want to spend all of our time on it. I just think that there's a, from my perspective, when I hear somebody like you speaking about it, what I feel is I didn't want to believe in the fact that we're forfeiting our future due to climate change. Believe me, you know, I would have been much happier. I would have liked to have written some novels. You know, I spent 9 or 10 years working on this book, exploring a lot of subjects that I didn't even know or understand how to think about very well at first because I felt called to do it, you know, when I hear your tone, even your frequency, it's like this resistance to just facing something which is self, from my perspective, pretty self-evident. Like, you know, New York, you never can walk around in late January in a t-shirt, you know, until like the last couple of years. You know, all around the world, there are these tremendous changes happening. You know, these giant ice glaciers are breaking off. You know, we're losing the albedo effect. You know, they're pretty clear about all the feedback loops. It's not an infinite system, you know. And so, you know, from my perspective, like when I listen to somebody you're talking, it's like, it's almost like, I feel it's like the last gasp of a certain type of individuality, you know, that wants to not believe that, you know, the mainstream consensus can be right about something. It's the same energy that's gone into kind of, you know, saying that even though the mainstream media is sometimes fucked up and sometimes supports, you know, military CIA stuff and so on, that it can never be right about anything. You know, there's a kind of like, I feel in America right now, there's a kind of a collective hysteria. It's like a histrionic undertone that's making us unable to even agree on very basic things. And it is very frightening, to be honest.
Well, you just kind of lay a lot of bullshit on the table there. I mean, I've done 330 shows now on Skeptico, primarily about consciousness and getting past the crazy materialism. We are biological robots in a meaningless planet that, you know, is dominant in science, and you talk about some in the book, which we are totally in sync with. And that has led me to looking broadly at spirituality and what role spirituality plays in consciousness and what is the interface and what are the extended realms of consciousness as we understand them through psychedelics, but also through near-death experience and through all these other means. So I don't know what frequency you're hearing from me or what label you're hearing from me. But, you know, part of my investigation has been the understanding that our understanding about consciousness, our insistence that consciousness is an illusion, which is just such a crazy, crazy idea, but is still mainstream science, is still the dominant paradigm, that is...
What do you mean by an illusion?
Well, you know, famously, Daniel Dennett, 20 years ago, wrote that consciousness is an illusion. I mean, that is fundamentally the position of the materialist, is that there is no such thing as consciousness, right? That is the epiphenomena of the brain, mind equals brain. That is materialism. That is physicalism. Consciousness is an illusion, right? Are we on the same page, right?
Yeah, I suppose. I would have thought, yeah, I see what you're saying. More of an, I mean,
Dennett wrote. Dennett wrote, consciousness is an illusion. And if you look at
through Google as we go over these things. Yes, you're right. I thought more of epiphenomenon, you know, but yes, he says an illusion. Okay, that's crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy. And it's crazy. So no one says that anymore because it's crazy. I just listened the other day, you know, Sam Harris is talking to David Chalmers. You know who those two people are, right?
Of course.
So of course. And they're having this discussion. They're going, you know, we know Dan, he can't really believe that, does he? I mean, he said this consciousness is an illusion. He's this old guy. He's going to pass away, another casket that changes the paradigm. But does he really mean it? Because no one could even, these guys can't even find a way to prop up that silliness. But we still live in that materialist mind equals brain world, right? So for me to jump over on the other side and say, well, wait a minute, you know, these guys have an incredible ability to distort the truth. I'm open to anyone who says, hey, let's look into this a little bit further. Let's be slow down the idea that it's all settled, that we all know everything. You know, to now get off the global warming thing. But I just heard the guy from Greenpeace, and I totally get what the former past president of Greenpeace. And I totally get where he's coming from. He said, hey, you know what? When I started Greenpeace, we were worried about all sorts of environmental issues regarding humanitarian efforts. We were particularly concerned about like atomic bombs. We got 100 atom bombs running around the world, at least 100, that we don't know where they are. They're lost. They're out there on their own. We don't talk about that. We don't really talk about, you talked a little bit about destruction of the creatures in the sea that are, we're just depleting that. You know, we don't talk about any of that because what the agenda has been set, it's all about global warming. Global warming has happened. It's catastrophic. We got to jump in here. We got to take control of this thing. God needs our help on this one. I want to put the brakes on that a little bit and make sure we really are looking at the science.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so, I mean, I did my best to try to understand it from my limited perspective. And, you know, I think the planetary boundaries model is quite a good one. And it seems to me there's very good evidence to think that climate change and global warming is happening. Although, yes, it is happening, you know, in, you know, kind of sometimes areas get cooler, sometimes areas get warmer, you know, it's, you know, but I don't think they're, you know, kind of hiding, you know, we're seeing an increase in temperatures. You know, we know the methane is another issue. And, you know, if we're going to address, you know, all of these issues, you know, not just climate change, but the whole nine planetary boundaries model, it's going to require human society to move in a new direction.
Okay. So let's move off of that for a minute, but kind of a related point, because I think it really is at the crux of what gets at people when they get past the hysteria of the science, because the science is distorted. And you understand and acknowledge that it's distorted by certain groups who are pushing it in the direction, away from the direction you want to go. I can see some groups who are distorting it the other way. So I can point at ClimateGate and this most recent thing and all that stuff. So we forget all that.
I mean, ClimateGate.
Go ahead.
No, it just seemed to be like a very blown out of proportion thing. You know, it's hugely blown out of proportion. And for me, it's even like the way, I mean, it's also part of this right-wing disinformation machine where they find these things and they, you know, kind of make this Watergate reference. So you have Pizzagate and ClimateGate. But for me, that's at this point a sign that there are powerful right-wing forces, aka Koch brothers, et cetera, who are kind of deviously plotting, you know, ways to kind of create these kind of obstructions and misdirections, you know, so that we don't have a unified front around dealing with a situation that threatens all life on Earth. I mean, if you go back to Rex Tillerson, you know, what his perspective on climate change is, yeah, it's really happening. He knows it's happening. But he says that humans just adapt. They adapt to new situations. Well, it's awesome to adapt to a new situation when you're worth $300 million and probably have houses, you know, in various mountaintops. It's not so easy to adapt to a new situation like sea level rise when you live in Bangladesh at 0 to 5 meters above sea level and you're going to lose your ability to farm, and India is building a wall to keep you out. You know, so essentially our negligence around dealing with, you know, our you know, CO2 emissions, you know, is a genocidal policy against a huge swath of the developing world. You know, it's you know, very serious stuff, man. I don't know what else to tell you.
Yeah, wait, I gotta pull some of that apart. ClimateGate is a right-wing conspiracy overblown. Tell me there. Tell me what you understand about ClimateGate. In 2009, an insider feels like science is being hijacked and releases all these emails. What is a right-wing conspiracy about that? What is overblown about that? A lot of people think it's the greatest public display of science scandals, science misinformation in history. These guys are saying, don't send this person the data, hide the data this way. I mean, I don't understand what your pushback is on ClimateGate.
Well, from what I read, and I obviously haven't studied it as much as you have, so I'm not going to go toe-to-toe with you on it, is that they seem kind of like minor emails. Sorry. And once again, I have to go back into it. I'm not going to go there. I mean, you know, I just go back to what I said at the beginning, you know, however things are being, you know, yes, people have political ends and they doctor things in certain directions, you know, for those ends. But, you know, we're putting, like, you go around the world, cars, factories, CO2, 275 parts per million, stable climate, 400 parts per million, guaranteed 40 degrees Celsius, warmer climate, 100-foot sea level rise at some point. Not incremental. Methane under the ocean caused Permian mass extinction. What was it, 250 million years ago or something? You know, 95% of all life on Earth, including all large mammals, went extinct at that time. You know, I don't think it's brain surgery at this point. I'm sorry, but let's try to get onto something else.
Okay, we'll try and get onto something else. I could respond to all that, but I'm not going to, because I don't want to waste your time, and I want to try and get some of this out there, because the issue behind this for a lot of people, and you've put this on the table already, so we got to kind of hammer out this right-wing thing, because you keep all outright and all this stuff, and that's not me. I am so post-partisan that it's, you know, it's crazy. I believe the whole thing is just crazy. I voted for Hillary. That's before I knew about the whole Pizzagate thing. If I did, I would have never voted for Hillary, but I don't think you believe in Pizzagate either, so we won't go there. But I am post-partisan. I don't care. I don't care, because I don't believe that they can make a difference. But from the issue of, do we want to ride this globalist train that has been going for the last 20 years, or do we want to pull back and create a more of a nationalistic kind of perspective? You seem to have a very strong opinion on that. The country in the U.S. seems to have turned and said, we really don't want to go down the globalist thing as much. We'd rather go down the nationalist path. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's very short-term thinking. I mean, I'm not, you know, for the New World Order, neoliberal, you know, globalization of Obama and Clinton, you know, partly because, you know, largely because I felt that in terms of the ecological crisis, they weren't, you know, doing what needed to be done. And also in terms of things like economic inequality, you know, it was just getting worse and worse and so on. You know, I definitely feel that in a sense, like the, you know, the financial elites and the cultural elites abandoned the middle of the country to be kind of information deserts as well as food deserts. And, you know, I was concerned about this years ago when I started Evolver. We created something called the Evolver Network. We were trying to build a kind of social movement of local groups, local community groups in the U.S. and abroad, to kind of, you know, spread different ideas, transformational culture ideas, you know, permaculture, alternative currencies, participatory, decentralized democratic systems, shamanism, you know, kind of a different approach to nature and so on. You know, I felt that was more of a better direction. You know, I think that in the future, you know, the national boundaries are ultimately going to matter less, particularly as a lot of the effects that are already irreversible of the ecological crisis get worse, such as sea level rise and so on. And ultimately, we're going to shift to a circumstance that's more, local, then bioregional, and then planetary as our framework. And I think the way to do that is to use the internet to start to create participatory democratic systems so that people can be fully engaged rather than just having, a stupid vote where you have to vote for one of two pathetic, idiotic candidates every 4 years. There should be a way through the instantaneous communications medium of the internet that people can be actively engaged in an ongoing process. And in fact, if you look at the history of political economic systems, they're tightly linked to the evolution of media. So you would never have had an empire unless you had a written code of laws. You would never have the modern liberal, democratic nation state until you had a printing press. So I feel that the internet points towards a new way that human society could orchestrate itself that would be much more participatory, much more based on direct democracy.
Sounds good, but what if people don't want to go along? One of the problems we're facing right now, this moment in the U.S., is there's this huge dissension and there's this huge kind of rising up of saying, you know what, participatory government is great, but when it doesn't go my way, I got to find a different path, which I think is great in one sense, but in another sense, how do we as a country, United States, Bill of Rights, we lost our Fourth Amendment during Obama. We lost our Fourth Amendment unlawful search and seizure that, back in the 60s was paramount. I mean, everyone fought for it. Well, Bush killed it, and then Obama just further drove it into the ground so that it'll never rise up again. This is the pushback, I think, is the sense of the nation is, individual rights, if I don't protect my individual rights, they will be taken away by the state. And right now, that's the most important thing to me. So they hear, I think, in what you're saying is, wait a minute, this is another rewarming up of the globalist agenda that says we have to give away all our rights so that the state, so that some state entity can protect us, whether it's terrorism or whether it's, in this case, environmentalism.
Alex, did you read my book? That has nothing to do with anything that I discuss or write about in the book.
How can you say that? I think it has a lot to do.
As I said, I don't even really, I think that these nation states are part of the problem, what you're describing, it's like, I feel that it would be better and maybe more useful if somehow I was able to maybe go over the basic gist of the message of the book.
Why don't you do that, Daniel? But let me just tell you a little bit about where I was heading, and then I'll let you do that. That I think is the point of the book. The point of the book are all these ideas about how we need to change, why we're going to change, why it's the only way, and all this. And I think to try and bring it into perspective of what's going on today, that's what's really at the core issue is globalization versus nationalism. But please tell me what I'm missing there.
I see it as globalization and nationalism versus something else it's still an idea, but I would call it something more like planetization, from the cultural philosopher William Irwin Thompson. We need to get out of these broken, obstructed old identity forms and recognize that ultimately, each of us is a catalytic agent of a whole ecosystem. And at the moment we're causing cascading destructive effects that will lead to our future destruction. It's pretty obvious that that's what's happening. So then we need to step back. And when you say, okay, we don't want to, we want humanity to thrive, so what does that take? Well, we can't keep consuming the kind of way we're consuming, so we got to do something different. Now, if you look at past epochs, there are times when people came together, for some greater cause or greater initiative. And often it's remembered even as something incredible later on, whether it was like England during World War II or something, or even the way, and there's also times when we've been able to mobilize even complex societies to make a rapid change in direction. So for instance, the U.S. during World War II, after Pearl Harbor, we were able to redirect our entire factory production in 3 months towards wartime production. And we put a tax on the wealthy of as much as 94%. you know, to have the resources to you know, defeat the Nazis and not be taken over by them in a sense. So you know, we're actually, when you really, from my perspective, and I know you seem to reject some of the data, if you look at the ecological circumstance, you know, we need that type of unification. We need to come together as one human family and forget about, you know, going 5% more renewable in 50 years. Let's go 100% renewable in 10 years. You know, most people are sitting around doing jobs that have no relationship to the ecology of the earth. They're just, you know, they're doing things that are just net negative. You know, we could be providing people with a basic income, you know, so, and subsidizing people, retraining them so they can live in home communities. You know, I'm a great believer in individuality and individual rights and so on, as long as those rights don't involve the right to control other people's lives or you know in all the different ways that this right wing movement is trying to do it, you know. So let's protect people's rights and freedoms, but let's repurpose human society so that we can live on this planet harmonically.
So there's a lot to pull apart there, but I want to make sure that you have a chance to, is there anything else about the book particularly that relates to what you're just talking about? Because I don't want to talk over that.
You have to actually ask me questions about, like, you know, the ideas in the book. I mean, I look at, for instance, the monetary system, you know, like, for instance, money now, you know, is an instrument that's based on debt, that's forcing excess consumption and makes people, you know, live in fear. You know, it's an instrument for a certain type. It's, you know, our tools shape us, shape our consciousness and our values. You know, so for instance, you know, all around the world now, you know, debt is rising like 7% per year, you know, based on compounded interest and so on. Whereas GDP, which is a terrible measure in any case, is only rising about 2% per year. You know, so basically people are forced to like work harder and harder for less and less, you know, in a system that's destroying the planet and not bringing much happiness.
Oh, Daniel, that's a hard one. I mean, when people talk about debt and they talk about money, I'm sorry, what?
What's hard about that?
Is that what is the alternative? There's a time value of money. There's debt associated with money. So I think the Federal Reserve is a complete sham, right? I mean, most people don't even know that the Federal Reserve isn't a federal agency. But no, it's banksters that have kind of taken over and are running this scheme on us. But at the end of the day, when I hear people like you say this stuff, it's like removed from the reality that there's a time value of money. So
first of all, I don't know what you mean by people like me. I'm talking to you as an individual.
You've said people like me about 50 times in this interview.
Anyway, secondly, you know, the point is that there, money is an instrument. It's a design that humans design something that functions in a certain way. It's you know, and I wrote about this in the book. It's, you know, you can look at somebody like Bernard Lyotard, who was one of the architects of the euro, who's been seeking to create other designs for instruments for exchanging value that don't have the same inherent problem. So for instance, you can have a trading currency that has a negative interest or a demurrage charge. So people are actually penalized for hoarding it. So rather than trying to hoard it, you know, people then just keep it in circulation. And that has a great, you know, kind of corollary when you think about how energy moves through a body. You know, if you think about humanity as like a collective body, you know, we don't store energy, like, you know, cells don't hoard energy and keep other cells starving. You know, energy moves, you know, where it's needed. You know, so money should ultimately be a tool, or however we exchange value should be a way to get energy where it's needed, not to allow it to be hoarded, you know, by 50 billionaires who control more wealth than like 2/3 of the population. It's ridiculous.
Right. What I was trying to get at before was, all these things require, I assume, because you said you're into individual rights and protecting the rights of individuals, they require some sort of consensus, some sort of representative government. It just doesn't seem like people are interested in going down any of these paths that you're talking about in a large number. And that's what I was alluding to.
I disagree with you. They haven't been presented with the option. The media has a hold on their minds. Their consciousness is controlled and programmed by a tiny elite. They haven't been given an option for a truly equitable, truly decent way of approaching this circumstance. They haven't been given tools for participatory democracy. They haven't been given a free internet so they can learn about what's happening. Their minds are controlled by a fucking small group of assholes.
Well, you know, earlier on, you were kind of defending the mainstream media, saying, hey, they don't get everything wrong. Certainly they don't get everything wrong.
There is no inconsistency in my perspective. It's highly coherent. I spent years developing it. I feel that you're not, like, I don't know, maybe we would need to spend 6 hours haranguing this out. I don't think it's going to happen in one podcast. It's highly coherent and it's systemic. You know, we have a systemic illness going on. You know, people are lost. People are confused. People are scared. You know, the whole system is designed to make them that way. You know, we can put this thing back into balance, but first we have to have the imagination that it's possible. And that's what great thinkers like Oscar Wilde and Buckminster Fuller and Hannah Arendt help us to have, that imagination. You know, so we have to realize that it doesn't have to be this way, that we could actually create a harmonic system that works in resonance, in harmony with the ecology of the earth as a whole system. We could do that, okay? Just in the same way we figured out how to fly, just in the same way we figured out how to make smartphones and extract all these rare minerals and fossil fuels from the environment, we could now turn our attention to how do we make this thing work for all human beings, for the entire human family. We have the technical capacity to do that, as Buckminster Fuller said. It's a design problem. And it's an imagination problem.
Okay. I think it's okay to disagree. So, I mean, I don't have a problem that you don't see my ideas as coherent or even sensible or anything like that, or that I don't see yours as coherent. I mean, that's really not the issue. That's the.
I'm going to meet you with the same level of force that you're meeting me, because otherwise I feel that, you know, it's just like I'm not even getting a listening here. I'm sorry, you know?
Okay, that's why I paused before to make sure that you had a chance to talk. So let me kind of respond to what you're saying in really a new way, okay, that I think relates to your book in an important way, in the way that is synergistic with my approach. Because, you know, is it possible that the material world that we're talking about, right, because there's this spiritual extended consciousness world that we're talking about early on that may exist and may have a totally different set of rules than this material and justifies the means, we have to do this or do that. Those two worlds could be different in some important ways that we don't realize. I'm just throwing that out as a possibility. So isn't it possible that it's true what a lot of spiritual teachers tell us, is that in some way we don't quite understand the world is always perfect, just the way that it is. And, you know, I was thinking the other day when I was preparing for this interview, I was talking to my friend, Rick Archer, who does this show, Buddha at the Gas Pump. And he introduced me to Amma. Do you know Amma, the hugging saint?
Absolutely. I've gotten 3 hugs.
Okay, great. Great. So you go see Amma, right? And no matter what...
But by the way, Alex, the idea that the world is already perfect is actually an idea that's totally in my book. I talk about the idea of samsara and nirvana ultimately being the same thing. And I talk about how, like, for certain psychedelic experiences, particularly 5-MeO-dimethyltryptamine, which is, you know, the purest source of it comes from the bufo toad in the Sonoran Desert, you know, gives you an immediate experience of nirvana, subject-object, non-duality, subject-object, pure bliss. And there's every reason to think that is underlying, you know, the illusion of the manifest reality. But that doesn't change our responsibility, you know, out of our innate empathic nature to deal with the disaster that we've constructed on this planet right now.
Well, that would be another question, right? So we can talk about that as whether that does, you know. Here's I guess. Let me finish the Amma story, and then I'll make that point with another story. So because you've been to Amma, right? So you've been there 3 times, 3 hugs. Amma is amazing. For anyone who's listening that doesn't know, Amma is this woman of extremely humble, horrible, really, origins in India, who at a very early age felt this awakening, this spiritual transformation that she went through, and was guided to help the world. And the one thing that's undeniable about Amma, if you go see her and you're like this kind of skeptic, what's the scam here, whatever. One is they're just beautiful people. They don't charge anything. You can go see Amma and get a hug and it doesn't cost you anything. And if you want to stay there, it's a very minimal fee and they give you great food and all these classes. It's a great experience. But the sheer physical feat that she does of sitting there 18 hours a day regularly, hugging one person after another. You don't think it sounds like a lot, but it's got to be grueling. And sometimes when she goes to India, it's not 18 hours a day. It's 24. It's just an amazing physical feat. And in India, she'll hug people for 18 hours and then she'll dig latrines, right? But here's the story that Rick told me that I thought was so amazing. One of her devotees goes up to Amma at some point and says, you know, Amma, I don't get it. At one point, you're telling us that this is all Maya, this is all illusion. We don't have to worry about this world. And on the other hand, you're so busy doing all this stuff, right? And Amma's response is, world? What world? So somewhere in between that story and your story is a balance that I'd like to seek. Because I see Amma and I see her call to action and her choice of how she acts as being different in some important ways, because it's about personal, it's about connection, it's about heart to heart. It's not about thinking that we need to find our allies to go fight this system versus that system and change the world. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, once again, it's like every time you try to characterize my perspective, I have an instant sense of total retraction, because I feel it's a mischaracterization, you know. But it's subtle and it's complex, and you know, I don't know if we're going to get, you know, to an agreement in the course of this conversation. Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said, I agree that samsara is nirvana. My whole perspective is that it's out of our hearts. That, you know, that first of all, I don't think hearts and minds are separate. I mean, I think there are neurons, you know, in the heart. You know, the heart is also a thinking organ, you know, and we have the capacity to descend into our hearts and think from there. And when we do that, we realize that, you know, this situation that we're in is deeply fucked, right? And you know, and we're heading.
Not everyone thinks that. You think that, but not everybody agrees.
Okay.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, you call me, you keep calling me on some tone or something that I have. I mean, you're just kind of laying out this stuff and just saying we have to accept it as truth. Well, no, there's two sides to it.
With narcissistic personality disorder, you know, able to launch 4,000 nuclear missiles at any moment, you know, we're losing 10% of the Earth's remaining biodiversity every 10 to 15 years, you know, I mean, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, yes, I mean, there are beautiful things about the world and there's progress that's happened, you know, but even some of that, you know, is double-edged, you know, like for instance, you know, we are in love with our gadgets and our smartphones and our laptops, but those are also causing not only ecological destruction, but genocide. It's estimated that 3 million people have died in, you know, Africa through conflict minerals. Like, you know, so, you know, it does seem to me that most people would agree, you know, that you know, the situation is very difficult and you know, tilting towards getting worse on many levels. You know, maybe, you know, maybe it's not universal that people would agree with that. And you know, yes, in some ways it's gotten better, which I also address in the book. But the point is that, you know, and I guess my perspective is, without getting to a systemic understanding, you know, of what we're doing to ourselves ecologically, you know, and so on, and we're not going to be able to have a systemic solution, you know. And, you know, in the book, I go into areas, for instance, you know, that are controversial. And I don't expect everybody to, like, agree with the ideas in the book, but just to have an alternative model, you know, like an alternative vision for how things could change, you know. I mean, you know, so for instance, in the book, I talk about, you know, love and relationships and alternatives, you know, that people might look at in those areas to, you know, the nuclear family, the monogamous, you know, model that you know, has been established since, you know, the origins of patriarchy and so on. You know, and as I said, I look at the potential for, you know, reinventing the ways we exchange value so that they're not destructive to the Earth's ecology. You know, how we could rethink our political systems so that it's more based on, you know, people having a continuous participation rather than having, you know, essentially meaningless vote every 4 years, which leads them to mass frustration and voting for, you know, somebody who, you know, should not be anywhere near that type of power, and so on and so on.
Great. So again, the book is How Soon Is Now. How is the book going? Who do you expect to reach with the book, and what's been the effort so far in getting out the word been like?
The book is still just coming out. It just came out in the UK. And, you know, I'm doing my best to get the word out. I tend to think it's a good book. You know, I tend to think it's going to change the way people think about the world. I mean, just yesterday, you know, I'd sent an early version of a PDF out to somebody who's like a surgeon and a, you know, investor here. You know, when he met me, he was really, really thankful and grateful and kept hugging me and telling me that, you know, the book had given him a totally different perspective. And actually, I thought it was quite intriguing that he was a doctor, because I feel in a way, you know, a great doctor doesn't just treat symptoms, but gets down to causes. And I feel in a way that's what I had to do in the book, is get below the surface level of the symptoms, you know, so we could actually maybe have at least an opportunity or possibility that we could actually treat the causes, because otherwise we're just going to keep perpetuating this thing.
Well, I think all of us who are out there and interested in consciousness, which how can you not be interested in consciousness unless you're a materialistic scientist? But if you're interested at all in the really revolution of consciousness, you have to applaud your work, Daniel. You've been instrumental in bringing these issues to the forefront, and the discussion is always good, even if it gets a little bit heated. So I'm certainly very, very happy that you decided to join me today and talk about all this stuff. And I do wish you the best of luck with the book.
Thanks, sir. And I'm happy to do it again, but maybe we can do a little pregame beforehand and figure out how we can have a less contentious and more.
Why would we ever want to do that? No, no, no.
All right. Fair enough. Thanks for talking to me. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks again to Daniel Pinchbeck for joining me today on Skeptico. After this interview, which again sounded like it ended on relatively good terms, we had a very heated email exchange. And I just have to say, the heat was really generated by Daniel. I guess I pushed a lot of his buttons, but it really centered around two points, which I think are really central to what's going on, and not just politically, but more broadly in the skeptical world that we kind of live in terms of spirituality and science consciousness intersection. And those had to do with ClimateGate and Pizzagate, believe it or not, because he really pushed back with me in this email exchange, first about ClimateGate, and he goes, totally blown out of proportion. And as you know, if you've looked into it, I mean, that's just total bullshit. I mean, there's just no defense for the idea or for the evidence, I guess I should say, that these scientists conspired to cook the books. And like I told Daniel, go read the emails. Read Professor Phil Jones' emails about the trick to hide the decline. That's exactly what he says. We're trying to hide the decline, which is what everyone thought they were doing. And that's why everyone was pressing them for the data, and they wouldn't release any of the data. And then they got the hands on the email, and there it is saying, hide the decline. And there's tons of those emails that say that. And there's other emails that say, don't send this one to this guy. And then the real clincher, you know, delete all these emails. Tell everyone else to delete all these emails. Go read this stuff. It's right there. It's undeniable. And it just surprises me when somebody like Daniel then says, like he did in our email exchange, well, there's been panels that have been put together and they found no wrongdoing or nothing that serious anyway. It's just unbelievable. You know, it reminds me of The Simpsons when Mayor Quimby, you know, says, hey, I've put together a blue ribbon panel. And then Lenny says, blue ribbon, you can't get any better than that. I mean, that's what it sounds like. Just read the frickin' emails. And then with Pizzagate, exactly the same. I tell you, anyone who has really gone and read those WikiLeaks emails and read the Instagram post and looked at all those pictures and looked at all that crazy shit, if you've really done it, if you've really dug into it, and you've looked at all the evidence we have of this kind of shit going on in Nebraska with the Franklin affair, and in Belgium where the highest ranking judicial officer was deeply involved in covering this stuff up, and in England and over and over and over again. If you've really looked at all that, and you can come and you can talk to me, you can send me an email directly and tell me that Pizzagate is just fluff and there's nothing there and it's just this crazy conspiracy theory, hey, bring it on. Love to hear it. Love, love, love to be proven wrong and pulled out of that cesspool, let me tell you. And again, if you followed this show, you know, this isn't really my stuff. I mean, climate change isn't really my stuff. Certainly, Pizzagate and those kind of evil scandals. You know, that's not really my thing. What's my thing is how do we sort through the data to figure out what's real so I can make better decisions about how to live my life. So what becomes frustrating for me and challenging for me is when two people like me and Daniel go looking for the data, find the data, and then wind up on opposite ends of the debate. I acknowledge at this point that it happens, but I can't resist wanting to probe that and pick at that and understand how that happens. And that's what I think, for me, this show was really all about. Here's one question to tee up from this interview. What do you think we can do to increase the chances that intelligent people will be able to have real dialogues about these issues and get past the polarizing political situation that we're in now? Do you think that will happen, or do you think we are fundamentally stuck right now in a way that is not going to immediately fix itself? So the way to answer that question is through, well, I guess there's a number of ways. You can do it through the Skeptico website. You can do it through the Skeptico forum, which is where I like to hang out most of the time. You can connect with me on Facebook, or you can just think up the idea to yourself and not tell anyone, and that way we'll have no way of knowing what you really think. I'm just kidding. I don't want you to do that. I want you to connect, and I want you to pump your ideas back into this community, because I love this Skeptico community, and I've gained so much from it, and I want other people to gain from it, no matter what your view is. So I do hope you come to the Skeptico table. I do hope you tell me what you're thinking. I do hope you share this show with other people and get them involved in the conversation as well. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I can't remember off the top of my head how they all come in order, because some of them are kind of chopped up, but there's some really interesting stuff coming up. I love doing this stuff, and I think I have some good content to bring you in the future. Do stick around for all of that. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.